Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good day, everybody. We want to welcome you to this week's edition of Here's to Your Health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Ron Epley, and with me as usual is...
your other co-host, Dr. Shane Goforth. So remember, this is a call-in show, so we'll encourage people to give us a call. That number is 347-989-8722. So give us a call, and we'll try to get you on the air with us.
So I just wanted to start off emphasizing again what we've talked about a little bit, and that's the omega-3 levels are your best predictor of mortality. Right, so Dr. McCullough writes that. We talked about it, I think, last week or the week before. And in my mind, it's pretty important because, according to the study, it's a better predictor of mortality than serum cholesterol is.
Right.
And it's so right. Under, people so underappreciate their fish oil status, right? And,
right.
I mean, I try to get all my new patients to do that, but they're just not aware that that's what it is. And if you talk about their cholesterol, it seems like for a certain demographic, everybody knows their cholesterol level because their doctors pretty much got them bullied into believing they have to measure that every time they go see them.
Right. Yep, that seems about right.
I remember last time I went to the doctor, which is rarely, if ever, they wanted to measure my cholesterol levels, and I go, nope, sorry, I don't need to worry about it.
Right. I know, I've told people that, too. It doesn't matter, test if you want, I ain't doing nothing about it.
Deal
to me.
I'm not, but the fish oil is a big deal to me, so that's why I wanted to reemphasize that one. So here we go, there's growing evidence that probiotics are now good for your liver.
Good. Well, that makes sense.
This study was done in experimental biology, and it said in mice, probiotic treatments were shown to protect against liver damage from acetaminophen, which is Tylenol.
Right.
Which, by the way, I don't know why anybody's taking Tylenol for any reason other than a fever anymore, because it's been shown to be no better than placebo and it's, as an analgesic.
Right. Huh.
So,
that's interesting.
But I guess if people are going to choose to take it, even though it doesn't work, then I guess they probably should take a probiotic with it as well.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see, where are we next here? Yep, irritable bowel syndrome patients obtain robust, enduring relief from home-based treatment program. So here's what they're saying in this study, is that we're seeing a growing trend of trying to get people to begin to take care of themselves at home and stuff, right?
Right.
And what they found is that when they educated these people, they came in for, a few office visits, mainly for education. And then what happened is it worked really, really well for them. Basically, it's what you and I do, Dr. Goforth. It's not as different than medicine. Because medicine, you go on and you get a prescription, right?
Right. Exactly.
And so with us, we always counsel our patients on... we counsel our patients on diet and nutrition, and we might put them on a modified elimination diet. We might put them on a detoxification program. But so we are always educating our patients about their diet and lifestyle. So what they found is instead of looking at how chiropractors deal with it, they decided to do this a little bit differently, and they found out, wow, this is very effective.
Right. Imagine that.
Kind of funny, isn't it? I know. Imagine that.
We do it right again. Jeez, it's tough being a quack, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I know. It's really tough.
Oh, well.
God, did I say this last week? Learning styles? No. This is something I keep seeing stuff over and over again in the science. Not the same one, but another study is very similar. So they look the same after 12 years of doing this. It says 3 cups of coffee a day protect against cancer, diabetes, heart disease, according to a coffee study from the United Kingdom.
There you go. So more is better?
Yeah, three cups. Well, you know, you and I know that. We keep reading this stuff all the time. There's a new study that they'll check one thing, and all of a sudden 3 cups of coffee is good. Then another one will say, well, 5 cups of coffee is good. I haven't seen one yet that says anything more than 5 cups a day is good. But again, more is better. That and many of these circumstances, you just don't quite get the health benefits from low dose.
Right.
And, you know, and I think probably some of the health benefits are not just the antioxidants and stuff in coffee, right? I think some of it's just the amount of fluid people get because, you know, if I drink 2, 3, 4 cups of coffee in a day, I'm getting a lot of liquid, right?
Right. Exactly right, too. That's which is not a bad thing, right? So you got to stay hydrated somehow. You know, it used to be the joke, well, you know, you'd tell your patients, oh, I drink a lot of water or whatever, and then they'd be like, well, coffee's water, right? You know, I just filtered it through the coffee. So, but now it's not so much a joke anymore. That's just the way it works.
Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, I remember people saying that, too. Well, can I have my coffee? Because, well, I don't see people addicted to coffee like I used to. I mean, people that get – I don't see so many people that come in with massive headaches because they're – you know, because they read something on the news saying the coffee's bad for them, so they're cut back on their coffee and they're coming in from massive headaches.
Uh-huh.
I used to see that about 20-some years ago, but not lately.
Right. Well, that, too, I think part of the problem wasn't just coffee, though. You know, it was a lot of it, I think, was sugar.
Yep, it was sugar.
Because, not, you know, how many people do we know that drink coffee that drink it black? Not as many, you know, as they'll
not
have all their foo-foo-y stuff in it. Right?
Yeah, and then the other thing is that I used to use that as an indicator if people were toxic, right? If they had a hard time processing the caffeine, then I knew they were a little bit toxic. Because that's one of the tests.
Right.
If you do a comprehensive detoxification profile, is they give people a couple of Tylenol, a couple of aspirin, and a couple of caffeine tablets. And then you look at their metabolic pathways as their body breaks them down. Look at their urine and blood. And if they have a difficult time breaking down the caffeine, obviously if caffeine hangs around too much, they get some sensitivity to it. So, but I'm not seeing that as much as I used to. But I see more toxicity, but just less problems with people and coffee these days. Might be because fewer people drink the coffee, right?
That could be.
So, this one was published in the British Journal of Psychology. I found this one, to me, it was absolutely fascinating. It says, are learning styles a myth? New research says yes. So you remember, we were taught this when we were young, that there's different learning styles.
That's right.
Like there's tactile learners, and then there's audio.
Yeah, there's a big college thing about that, too. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That'll be interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, it's a myth. That's what this study showed.
Yeah, interesting. Not very surprising.
The researchers enlisted hundreds of undergraduates in a study that involved taking the popular online survey of learning styles known as VARK, which stands for Visual, Auditory, Reading, and Kinesthetic. The questionnaire, you know, like we've all done in the past to figure out what style was. After the assessments, the students were enrolled in an anatomy course and were told to study in a way that is consistent with their style of learning. During the course, the researchers interviewed the students about the methods they used to study in order to see if they were adhering to the dominant methods. At the close of the course, the researchers assessed whether the study style had an effect on their final grades. It didn't.
Huh. Interesting.
So, yeah. So, it might, if I were to just think about this, I might say that all of us learn in all of those methods, and maybe one way for some things is a little bit better than others, right? But we use them all the time. But, you know, maybe for different situations that you could use something a little bit different. And sometimes it's not your learning style, it's a teaching style.
Right.
I mean, how many teachers
right.
have you
had
over the years, Dr. Gopher?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Say what you're going to say. I know what you're going to say.
It's quite a few. I mean, you can have the same subject matter, two different teachers, and one teacher, you're just looking at it going, what? What are you talking about? And then the next teacher's like, oh, well, can you teach us all the time? Because we get this, right? And, in fact, I actually had a class in before I was going to be a chiropractor, I was going to do electronics. And there was this one particular teacher, and it was a great example because we had a teacher, and we were trying to learn one particular thing about a component, and it was just everybody was struggling with this guy. And I say with this guy, the instructor, because everybody's having a tough time with the material. We had a substitute. He come in, and he says, hey, look, this does this, this, and that. That's it. Don't make it any harder than that. And we're all going, oh. And then the next day we lost it because we had the instructor back.
Yep.
That was it. So, I mean, it was
the
difference in the instructors.
Yeah, I really believe it's teaching style more than learning style that does it because, you know, again,
I
like you were saying, I think all of us have had teachers that are very inspiring to us, right? And another one with the same subject matter, a different grade level, it's like you'd rather slit your wrists open than go to class with those people.
Man, I'm telling you, I've been there.
So I would say if you got an instructor that you can't stand to listen to him talk, that maybe your audio or your visual learning style is better because you can read this stuff. You know?
Right.
Here's what I've always believed. I've seen it happen when I was in college. And I used to teach it when I used to teach at the Oregon Military Academy. And we just told people, you got to read the subject matter three times. If you read
right.
it three times, it'll be in your memory. And you may not know that you know it, but you know it. And then if you hear it, too, on top of it when the teacher is talking, then you can do it. So if you read it first and then the professor talks about it, you know what they're talking about. But most people don't want to read it. They just want to sit there and listen to what the instructor is saying, and then they're trying to maybe get it, and then they try to read it and cram for the test later.
Right.
But, and I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but in the times that I actually did that and took the time, because believe me, you know, there's a lot of reading in college, but
yeah.
if you get the time to read the subject matter
right.
that many times, it's committed to your memory because you and I know it, right? When we're talking on the radio or we're dealing with our patients,
right.
something comes up and it's something we learned a long time ago and you go, wow, where did that come from?
Oh, yeah, right. Been there. Yep, I remember that too. I remember instances like that. You just kind of wonder where it came from.
Yeah, where'd I learn that? Well, obviously, we learned it one time before. We probably read it or were tested over it or something, or we heard it a few different times in our college career, and we just never had to deal with it because you don't see patients, and all of a sudden a patient shows up with it, and you pull it out, and you go, well, that's cool.
Yep.
So, yeah, the learning style is probably our teaching style is probably more significant in the way kids learn and learning style. Plus, there's attention and the time of the day and all that other stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of factors, sure. But I think probably you're right. I think that the number one most important thing is the teaching style.
Yeah.
And also, I think, to that, not just to blast teachers in that respect, because that's not what we mean to do, is that it's about I think with some students, certain teaching styles are better than other students.
Yeah.
I think that's where they try to get into the whole learning styles. And I don't think it's necessarily – I think it's both, right?
Yeah.
They both have a component to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the rewards of meditation – are reaped for many years. Research shows that cognitive gains last even if you don't maintain the practice.
Huh.
Yeah, and these are published in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement. So that's cool, huh?
That's very cool.
So maybe it's because it improves your cognition and cognitive function and memory and all that other stuff, Maybe that's something they ought to be teaching our kids until they have a better learning style because they've meditated, huh?
Right. It's a good idea.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into all the details. It's interesting because some of these people meditated for like 6 hours a day. I go, sorry, I'm not going to enhance my brain by sitting there for 6 hours.
Right.
That's just one of the things I read. So I said, no, I'm not going to read the rest of it. So eating 15 almonds a day lowers bad cholesterol levels and decreases the risk for diabetes. Yeah, eating 15 almonds a day. Can you imagine? Here, I'm going to count my almonds now. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Just like you would. Well, you know, it cracks me up because I have so many older people come in here, and you try to tell them to take vitamin D or fish oil. I just don't like to take pills. Then you take a look at their medication list, and it's like a mile long.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like, well, so how about taking 15 almonds a day? No, no, I take too many things at once. Well, if you took the almonds, you won't need to worry about your cholesterol medication, and you might not be able to worry about your diabetes medication, so why don't you take the almonds?
Right. That's just too much work.
Too much work. Same thing what we were talking about, vitamin D, and it's reducing the risk of diabetes and reducing the risk of death and all that other stuff. Just take a few things that have a big bang for the buck. So here we go. This is a newer study, but it's something that I've been telling my patients to do all along. And it says reduce weight and inflammation by combining curcumin and purpurine with a calorie-restricted diet. Okay, so what they're telling you is to take turmeric with black pepper and reduce your calories in your diet, and you could reduce inflammation and reduce weight. So it's my number one thing that I recommend to my patients, who they never do, by the way, is I recommend the turmeric, a little bit of coconut oil in it, and or fish oil, and a black pepper, and say, take this. When I do get a patient that listens to me, and what they do is, you know, they listen because they'll come back and they'll do an internet search, and they'll find a recipe to put it together, right? And they'll put it on the stove and warm it up and make a little bit bigger batch rather than put it in a shot glass every day like I do. And then after a month or two or three, you start seeing incredible results of their inflammation. And so you know which ones do it because they always come back with this pepper work, will that pepper work? Because they're doing their search, right? So probably 1% of people that I tell to do this actually do it.
Yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
But it really works. When people do it, it works. It works like crazy. It's quite amazing. Oh, the other thing that people like to do is I tell them, just go buy turmeric. Go to like an Indian store that sell Indian spices, and you can buy a bulk bag of turmeric for fairly inexpensive. But if you go to Safeway or Fred Meyer or somewhere like that, a grocery outlet store or Walmart, and try to buy turmeric or curcumin that's in a pill form, you're going to pay out your nose.
Right. No kidding.
So just go buy the powder. It's fresher. It's better. It doesn't have all the other stuff in it. So, yeah. So here's an interesting thing, Dr. G. It says the best weight loss plan for diabetics is a huge breakfast, but a smaller lunch and dinner.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah, okay, so I was looking at it, right? Go, well, what are they doing? And here's what I think is happening. Because we always tell people to get 30 grams of protein within 30 to 60 minutes of waking up, and that's a really good way to get your metabolism working right. And so what I really think it is, if you look at how much protein they're getting in their breakfast, a huge breakfast finally gets you about that amount of protein. You don't get 30 grams of protein from a small breakfast.
Right.
So I think that's kind of what's happening is
that makes sense.
Getting much more protein, yeah. But there you go. So you tell your diabetics that hey, have a huge breakfast, a smaller lunch, and a smaller dinner, and it'll help with your inflammation, and it'll help with your diabetes, and to help you lose weight.
Right.
Huh. So let's see.
Total
where
win.
Are we at now? I know. Oh, this is an well. All these studies are interesting. I don't know. That's why I print them out and talk about them. It says the presence and the amount of gut bacteria can predict how fast pancreatic cells grow.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So that's a really, to me, that's a really interesting. Let's see. Science Daily reports recently on a research team's discovery that populations of certain types of bacteria, including groups of species called actinobacteria, proteobacteria, and fusobacteria, increase more than 1,000-fold in pancreatic cancer patients. This increase suppresses the immune function needed to kill cancer cells, leaving the body helpless against the swift growth of the aggressive form of cancer.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Interesting.
So,
yeah, it is.
It makes sense that if we're infected with bad bacteria and our immune system's occupied fighting it off, then we don't have an immune system capable of fighting off the cancer.
Right.
So, but isn't it interesting how often we're finding probiotics in the news, fish oil in the news, vitamin D in the news, right?
Yep.
We're finding it far more in the news. I know. That's why we recommend it so much, is it's just, it's so critical in what we're doing. And again, what I'm saying is they find these probiotic bacteria in there. These are not, evidently they're not real healthy bacteria, those ones. I'm not familiar with the specifics of those. But it makes sense why we want to increase our probiotics in our diet so we have healthier bacteria to squeeze out those other guys so they don't get a foothold. And some probiotic bacteria enhance our immune function. So,
right.
Okay. Researchers at Lund University in Sweden uncovered that cave dwellers ate in southern Scandinavia during the Paleolithic period. In their study, they found that a large part of the Stone Age people's diet was composed of fish.
Yep. Big surprise there, huh?
Yeah, big surprise, right? So they say people who follow the paleo diet should consume more fish to truly eat like a caveman. And that's what I tell my patients all the time. That's one of the reasons why we need more fish oil, because we're not getting enough fish, and that, you know, our ancestors lived near bodies of water. So what do you think was in those bodies of water?
Right.
Fish. How much easier is this to fish than it is to hunt?
Yeah, right? It's a lot easier. You can kind of sit there and wait. Put something in the water and come back later.
Yeah, especially for the days in winter when they had salmon runs, right? The only thing that might even remotely come close to salmon runs that are on a historical period, or just go to Alaska and look how much salmon's in the river. And if you talk to natives, like on the Columbia River, how much salmon they used to get out of the Columbia River, right? And so So hunter-gatherer people would just feast on salmon because there'd be so many fish coming up at a certain time of year.
Right.
And, of course, smelt runs. I remember when I was a kid going to smelt runs and just dip netting, got hundreds of smelt, filling up your 25-pound limiter or 20 – I don't remember how much the limit was. And our whole family out there, and, of course, you know, I have a huge, giant family just filling up buckets and buckets of smelt.
Right.
It's like I can't imagine – that people in Stone Age days, when there wasn't the population of people like there is now, the fish just must have been unbelievable, the amounts that there were.
Yeah, I know, right? I often wonder that, too. You talk about being able to walk across the water on the backs of the fish, you know, that's kind of kind of a lot of fish.
Yeah, I've dreamed about going to another planet that's just like Earth, right, and being the first people there.
Right.
And just be able to see the amount of fish that there were there and go, let me throw a line in the water and see if they jump out, the fish jump out of the water to eat me, because there's so many of them, right?
Yeah, right. Yep. That would be interesting. Oh, you're only 4 feet long. You're too small. Let's put you back. No kidding.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you're 4 feet long, and it only took me, you know, 45 minutes to bring you in. You're going back. I want those ones that took me 2 hours
right.
to land.
Yep, exactly right. Too funny.
Okay, so cure your depression by making these simple dietary changes. So, again, we're seeing more and more, Dr. Goforth, in the scientific literature about diet and lifestyle affecting depression,
right.
which that's what you and I have always said, but we're seeing more and more of it. So here's what this one is saying. They said protein, serotonin and dopamine, substances that make us feel good, are made up of amino acids or proteins. And so they're saying that we need to get more of these amino acids from proteins from our diet. So we need a little bit more protein in our diet if we're depressed. B vitamins, which you and I know B vitamins work, because I remember in college, they told us that, you know, I remember learning about sanitariums or mental hospitals back in the day were filled with
right.
people with mental diseases. And they found out that they were B vitamin deficiencies. That's why they fortified our food with B vitamins. You know, so they
yep.
one of the symptoms of a B vitamin deficiency are the 3 Ds, depression, dermatitis, and dementia.
Yep.
So anyway, so B vitamins makes a healthy fat.
Right.
Oily fish like salmon. There we go. Fish oil again, what we're saying for depression. Fiber. About 95% of serotonin is produced in the gut or gastrointestinal tract. Now, isn't that interesting, Dr. G? That when we were in college, we didn't know it was done that. But yet, there's been books called The Second Brain and all this other stuff, how much neurological
right.
tissue is in our guts. And now they're saying 95% of serotonin is produced in the gut. So how many people are depressed? You know, would the dietary fiber make a big difference if all of a sudden the bacteria in their gut started producing serotonin again?
Right. That'd be a big difference for them.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So anyway, so that's basically what they're talking about in there. Pretty cool. So basically what they're saying is eat healthy, just like we tell people to eat healthy, right?
Yep.
Eat healthy and fish oil, vitamin D, and probiotic, and there you go. So here we go, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It says, eating nuts and seeds are found to cut your risk of premature death by half.
Oh, nice. Unless, of course, you choke on one.
Yeah, I know. That's pretty amazing,
that's
right? So.
Yep. Very
yeah,
amazing.
There we go with those 15 almonds a day, huh?
Right.
Cut your risk of death of all causes by half. Oh, here we go. Here's some advice on how to turn up your happiness dial. So that's always a good thing. You want to be a little happier, do this. Here's what they recommend. They recommend you sleep more.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if you're happier because you sleep more, but you're a lot less grouchy, right?
Right.
And anybody that's ever had kids knows that if they don't get enough sleep, what they're like.
Oh, I know, right? Terrible little monsters.
Yeah, and we as adults, we don't act the same way, do we? But no, we just don't know we're terrible monsters because we're not getting enough
that's
sleep.
That's right. Right.
So here's what else it says. Indulge in a little dark chocolate.
Okay. Done. I can do that.
Woohoo! I'll do that.
Except
I'll do that.
Get some much.
Yep. Get some exercise. Meditate. Go outside. Of course, there's vitamin D outside, and also fresh air and natural sunlight. And then the last one, it says, be generous. Few easy things to be happy. Again, eat right.
Yep.
Or eat well, move well, think well. There you go. That's what it boils down to. Here's another thing to help make you happier. That's another study. It says having, quote unquote, fiddle fingers is a good thing. Research shows busy hands alter your brain's chemistry, making you happier. Okay, so this is, go ahead, Dr. G.
No, I was just thinking that was cool. That, you know, being busy, you know. What's the old saying, idle hands or devil's playground or something like that?
Here's what I think it really is related to on this, and that's why I wanted to bring it out. It's not just your fingers moving, right? It's just movement, plain and simple.
Right.
Because of all of it. That's what chiropractic does with proprioceptors and mechanical receptors. It's what things like the vibration plate that we have here, oscillating vibration plate. It's what our chiropractic adjustments do. It's what things like an arthrostim, which is a mechanical adjuster, does. It enhances mechanical or proprioceptive stimulus, which goes into the brain. And makes the brain work better. So this is interesting, Dr. G. I'm finding that there are a growing number out there of chiropractors that call themselves brain-based chiropractors.
Oh, really? That makes sense.
Yeah,
it's good.
There's a lot more than I thought. I keep running into them all the time. They call their clinic a brain-based clinic.
Huh.
There's a doctor in California that teaches chiropractors how to be more brain-based. And when you listen to what they say, here's the truth. They don't do anything different than you and I do.
Right.
It's just that they talk to their patients about the importance of their brain health, and they seem to attract people coming to them to improve their brain health versus trying to treat their back pain or neck pain.
Right.
So, so keep things moving. Stimulate the brain, fish oil, vitamin D, probiotics, you know what I mean? So it's all the same thing.
Yep.
So anyway.
Very good.
So they found in this study, they found that dietary supplement made from vitamin B3 provides the same benefits as calorie restriction for improving arterial health and reversing cardiovascular aging.
Nice.
Isn't that interesting? I guess there's it's an isomer, or it's it's called nicotinamide. It's similar to vitamin D3. And there you go. If it ever produces cardiovascular disease, it might be something to seriously consider as we're getting older.
Yep.
And then on all the amount of people that I see that are prematurely aging out there.
Right, which seems to be a lot.
So, commonly prescribed heartburn drug linked to pneumonia in older adults. Let's see, which one is it? They're proton pump inhibitors. That's what they are. So, over the years, we've been finding that these things are just bad boys, Dr. G. They reduce B12. Now they're increased to ammonia. And as you know, that when the CDC likes to use the numbers of the flu, it's flu / pneumonia, and they like to use the numbers as 33 or 36,000 people die a year from the flu, when it's really flu / pneumonia. And it's a small number in the flus, and almost all of them are pneumonia. So it's funny. If they want to prevent it, you got to get a vaccine. But don't interfere with your proton pump inhibitors. You need to take those. Those are over-the-counter, and those are safe.
Right. I know. It's craziness.
So I've been handing my patients a new prescription lately. And that prescription is based on this study right here. It says dark chocolate consumption reduces stress and inflammation.
Nice.
So believe it or not, because acetaminophen or Tylenol has been to be found to function no better than placebo, that I literally could give them a piece of dark chocolate and it's going to have a greater effect than Tylenol on their inflammation.
That's cool.
Yeah. Findings from two new studies show dark chocolate consumption reduces stress and inflammation while improving memory, immunity, and mood.
Very good. Very cool.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, right? It's we put together a bag for our patients to come in to do weight loss stuff, right? The bag's got things like a bottle of water, a glass bottle, because we don't want plastic stuff in there. And then we put a little baggie with this dark chocolate in there. And we say, you know, losing weight doesn't have to be painful. We give them a couple of pieces of dark chocolate to start them off. And then on a little card we attach to it, we have all the health benefits of dark chocolate, right? So it's like, some things are healthy for us that we don't think they are. Now, I was just having someone telling me, it was my son. I saw him over the weekend. Anyway, he was telling me that about dark chocolate. Since he switched to dark chocolate years ago, and that's all he ever does, just like I do, right? He said for some reason he was at some sort of food convention or something like that. I don't recall which it was. Said he tried to have some regular chocolate. He goes, it just about made him want to die because it was so awful tasting. That it's like, I got used to dark chocolate. And he can't stand regular chocolate anymore.
Right.
Well, you know the difference. Yeah, you do some dark chocolate now, right?
Yeah. I've always liked dark chocolate, but I try to get darker than, you know. But I haven't done enough to where I still don't like the other stuff yet.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't really care for the other stuff because it'll hurt my belly anyway because there's milk in it, right? But what I'm going with that is if you start off with dark chocolate, a lot of people will start off with the low percentage. And then as you get bolder and get used to it, you go to the higher and higher and higher percentage, or the more bitter it is.
Right.
And then you kind of get used to it at a higher level. And so, and less sugar in it. So you kind of get used to it where it's not as sweet. But you got a sweet tooth, so you like that sugar.
I do. It's more than a sweet tooth. It's a full blown addiction. I gotta really work on that addiction too. It's kicking my ass.
Good old sugar.
Yep.
So here we go. Drinking baking soda could be an inexpensive, safe way to combat autoimmune disease.
Really?
Says a daily dose of baking soda may help reduce the destructive inflammation of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, according to this new study from the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University.
Huh. Very cool.
Yeah. Now, it's just preliminary evidence. It's just some of the first evidence that they actually have that they're able to publish. But it's quite interesting. You know, when I was talking to a couple of patients about this, when I came out, they're going, it's the acidity and alkalinity. Nah, not likely.
Uh-huh. Right.
And more than just alkaline acid stuff that's doing this stuff. So I'm not going to go into it, but that's what it leads to in the rest of the study, that it's more than just acid-based stuff. Okay, so here you go. Soaking in a hot tub improves health markers in obese women.
Nice.
Okay, so listen to this. Listen to this, Dr. G. This makes sense to you, but I'm mainly wanting our listeners to listen. Heat therapy appears to reduce inflammation, improve insulin resistance, and lessen the effects of polycystic ovary syndrome. Okay, it appears to reduce inflammation. Did you hear that?
I did.
So that's the opposite of what we were taught when we were in college. Remember? Rest, ice, compression, and elevation. Right? Ice to reduce inflammation.
Exactly.
No, avoid the heat because it just causes people to inflame more.
Yep, that's what we were told.
And we know for a fact that that's wrong because, you know, the one study that's one of my favorites on the subject where they took rats and they contused their thighs, and then they put a single application of ice on their thigh and delayed healing response by 3 days.
Right.
And so I remember when I was young and in sports, they had all these ice baths and these, you know, all this stuff for ice. And it's like, oh, my God, I don't ever want to go do any of this stuff because this is awful. This is painful and this is torture. And these poor basketball players I saw with big drooping ice packs on their knees. Actually, the one I saw was Bill Walton. I remember seeing him. God, they were just terrible, the amount of ice they used on these people. And you think about it. These professional basketball players are playing basketball. They never went more than 3 days between games for the whole season, right? So they're constantly putting ice on them. They never heal.
Right. Doesn't seem like that's the smart way to go, does it?
Nope, it doesn't. So now, according to this study, heat is apparently anti-inflammatory.
Yep.
So there you go. So we need to probably prescribe hot tubs for more people, right?
Yep.
You know, speaking of hot tubs, that's one of my disappointments. Yeah, exactly. That's one of my disappointments with Obamacare, is remember in the old days, people that were in car wrecks and stuff like that, they'd get a settlement and they'd have the doctor prescribe them a hot tub. And, of course, it was therapeutic. I mean, I have a hot tub myself, and I know if you got some achy joints or whatever, it's kind of really nice to climb in a hot tub, especially if I've been not working in the yard and I'm not used to it. It really makes a big difference.
Exactly.
But I remember during that, when under George W. Bush, he wanted to push health savings accounts, of which if you have a health savings account, your doctor prescribed you a hot tub, you can go buy one and have it deductible as a health expense, right? Well, under this Obamacare, obviously everybody gets the equivalent to being on welfare now, and no one gets any heat therapy or anything.
Right.
So it's I'm sorely disappointed that those health savings accounts didn't come out. But you know, it would be a nice I would prescribe them for several of my chronic pain patients. You need a hot tub.
Yeah, right. It'd be good to do for a lot of patients.
Now, I don't necessarily believe that insurance should pay for it. You know what I mean? But if they have a health savings account, they're contributing their own money into an account. It's actually for a known health benefit. And if it's tax deductible for a health benefit, I think it certainly should be approved for that.
Yep. I agree.
So here we go. U.S. autism rate is up 15% over 2-year period. So guess what, Dr. G? Autism is continuing to grow.
Right. So that mean vaccinations are up?
Probably. So autism rate is 1 in every 59 in children ages over 8 years old. Now, here's the thing. The rate is 1 in 38 among boys and 1 in 152 among girls.
Kind of leads you to wonder if it's a bit hormonal based. Whatever antigens that's causing this problem.
Yeah, I just don't know. It's just it's amazing, right? But
there's
some things that affect boys more than others. That's what ADD does too. It affects boys more than others.
Right.
So you wonder if there's a lot of hormone disruptors out there that are contributing to all this, as well as the damage it does to your brain, right?
Yep.
So, the Mediterranean diet boosts beneficial bacteria. So, I'm going to say the paleo does too. So, but because we always say paleo / Mediterranean style diet. And all of it is basically eat more vegetables and you're going to boost the bacteria in your gut. Get away from a lot of the dairy and grains, right?
exactly right.
Okay, study finds low blood sodium levels are linked to impaired cognitive function in older adults.
Taking her salt.
So here we go again, Dr. B.
Not work as well, see?
So say that again.
Taking the salt away from doesn't help him. Makes your brain not work as well.
Have yeah, you know, it's like...
Well, you got high blood pressure. Let's cut your salt.
I know, especially older people who don't eat as much as other people. The older people that I'm used to being around, at least when I was younger, they kind of had a little bit of a sweet tooth, so they always had a little bit of candy hanging around, so they ate a lot more candy than they would have when they were younger. And they generally don't eat as much. And so if they're cutting, they've been told because of their high blood pressure and everything to cut back on the salt, and they cut way back too much, and now they're losing their minds because of it.
Yep. Right. Yep. Tragic.
I think so too. And you know, you try talking to people now and telling them that salt is good for them. It's like telling people a coffee is good for them. It's like telling them that their fish oil is more. They just don't get it. They've been brainwashed.
Or telling them that dairy's not good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or grains.
What do you mean? Where do you get your calcium, Dr. Goforth? If I don't have dairy, where am I going to get my calcium?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Maybe I should just gnaw on the bones of a cow or something, right? You know, I just eat my green leafies. That's all I do. In fact,
yeah,
you know what?
That's what the cows
my
do.
Daughter, that's right, my daughter actually just did a argumentative paper for her 8th grade English teacher, and it was on, is milk healthy? And so she was arguing that milk is not, dairy products is not healthy for us. And she goes on to say some other things, and then one of the things that she quoted from somebody in there was that there's more calcium in a cup of broccoli than there is in a cup of milk. Well, I'm like, well, there you go, you know. Of course, I wanted some numbers, but she didn't have that. That was okay.
Yeah.
I just thought it was pretty cool. You know, so there I'm quoting my daughter. I'm one of her quotes.
Yeah, I know. But it is funny how we've been brainwashed over the years, right?
Right. Exactly right.
So, eating more fish could prevent Parkinson's disease. So it says parva albumin, a protein found in great quantities in several different species of fish, has been shown to help prevent the formation of certain protein structures closely associated with Parkinson's disease. A new study shines more light on the link between the consumption of fish and better long-term neurological health.
Right.
You know, I remember many, many moons ago, before I became a certified chiropractic wellness practitioner, going to listen to Dr. Chestnut talk, Dr. James Chestnut. And he was blowing people's minds away when he said that almost all diseases are caused by toxicity and deficiency. Right. And I just never forget how up in arms a lot of our colleagues got was like, well, what do you mean? No. What about genetic stuff? And then how even people in alternative medicine and chiropractic were so brainwashed into believing all the BS out there that, I remember watching them just blow their minds away. They just could not believe it. But you know, over the years, everything I keep reading keeps showing that he was right all along. You know, he's not the most brilliant guy in the world either. You know, it's just that he reads stuff and then puts it all together, just like we read these stuff and put it all together, right? So, fish oil again. But this one they're talking about protein in fish, not necessarily fish oil. So you get how healthy for your brain are fish?
Very, apparently.
I mean, the oil is healthy for the brain, and now some of the proteins in there are healthy for the brain, too.
Right.
It's like, wow. That's kind of
I used to remember when I was a kid, people used to say fish was brain food. You know, food for your brain.
Did they really?
Yeah, I remember hearing that when I was a kid.
I don't remember hearing that at all, but it doesn't mean I just don't remember hearing it.
Right.
So good, we got something about vitamin D this week again. So it says vitamin D deficiency is linked to greater risk of diabetes. Yeah, I know. So, and again, they're talking blood levels above 50, which is what we have been saying for a long time. So we're starting to see them ratchet up the amount of vitamin D that they're recommending. We talked about this before. Remember out of college, they said 400 units of vitamin D is all we needed. Then they said 400 units, and older people needed 800 units. And then I remember seeing studies of 1,000, then 2,000, and now they're up to about 4,000 is what they're recommending a lot. And now I'm starting to see studies which are confirming what, what's the guy's name? I forget the doctor's name. I just forgot. Alex Vasquez, MD, ND,
right.
ND, naturopath, DC, chiropractor, and DO, doctor of osteopathy. That's his degrees. I remember him learning from him a long time ago that it should be above 50, and we're starting to see the rest of the literature catching up to what he says. Now, it's not that it wasn't in the literature that he got it from. He just got it more from research articles that don't make it to the regular news and to people. So I get it in both ways. I get this one comes from more and more stuff that are being published about it, kind of confirming what Alex has been saying for a long time. Oh, here they were saying, what's in a name? Researchers track post-traumatic stress disorders, many identities in war. And this headline got my attention because it's like, well, just listen to George Carlin. He'll tell you what they were.
Right.
Yeah.
he did too.
Yeah, he would call it battle fatigue, and he'd call it, what was all the words he used to use for it?
There was a lot of them, too. Shell shock.
Shell shock, that's one of them, yeah. And he would say things like, you know, words meant something at one time. You could tell what was wrong with a person by the word that they used to describe them, and he used to use these ones. He would say, shell shock. Now, if you said that they're suffering from shell shock, that's easy to understand because if bombs are blowing up around you, you'd be in shock too, wouldn't you? We all understand that. We go, oh, dude, that was terrible. Then they decide to change it to battle fatigue, which has a lesser meaning for the same exact thing. Bombs are still going off around you, only this time the bombs are bigger, right?
Right.
But instead of being shocked, you're just tired from battle. And we go, we can understand they're tired of fighting. But that's not nearly as bad as being shocked from the bombs blown up around you. And then he goes, then we took it all away from him by calling it post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, dude, I'm under a lot of stress, too.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, you know what I mean? So, It's funny. These guys could have just listened to George Carlin. But you know what? They probably wouldn't have got any research grants from doing that.
Yeah,
I'm trying
to
see if they said that. Yeah. Trying to see if they said any names in there. I probably pretty much said it all with George Carlin's routine.
Yeah, right.
Oh, here you go, Dr. G. This is going to be shocking to you. So be prepared. Are you sitting down?
I'm ready. I'm sitting down.
It says, the study predicts that the 2018 flu vaccine will likely have 20% efficacy.
Oh, big shocker. Man, you know, it's not that big a deal. It was only 30% this year. But they'll still tell you to take it. It'll still be good for you.
Yeah, exactly. They will. It says a new study of 6,610 human flu sequences predicts that this fall's flu vaccine will likely have the same reduced efficacy against the dominant circulating strain of influenza A as the vaccine given in 2016 and 17 due to viral mutations related to vaccine production in AIDS.
Right.
So we're being told to get vaccinated more and more and more, and they can't even develop a good vaccine anymore. It seems like the technology is getting worse for developing a vaccine. I mean, I thought we were getting smarter.
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently not. Maybe the vaccine developers had too many vaccines.
Let's see. Full accuracy data for 2017 flu is still being compiled, but they predicted that the flu vaccine effectiveness for the 2016-2017 would be around 19%. So the new one for this year is going to be about 20%. So pretty close to the same thing. Just not going to work, right?
Right.
I know. Yeah, I know. It's like, so why bother, Dr. Goforth? You know, you sit there and hear all these vaccine quacks out there trying to promote all their vaccines, right? And so one of the things that you constantly hear from them is you got to do it because herd immunity. So if we vaccinated 100% of people with the flu vaccine that's only 20% effective, how is the herd protected?
Yeah, I wonder too. Because it's they use it incorrectly. They use the herd immunity incorrectly.
Yeah, well, they talk
backwards.
It kind of is, because they'll talk about vaccination rates. When 95% of people are vaccinated, everybody's immune. 95%?
Right.
Holy crap, why don't you just say once everybody's got a vaccine, we're all immune? But now what we're beginning to understand is the effectiveness, the efficacy of a lot of these vaccines are real low. So even if you vaccinated 95% to achieve herd immunity, not that many people are actually immune because the vaccine just doesn't work. And then, you know, we've been talking about this before. They're finding the people that receive the flu vaccine, actually when they cough and sneeze, even though they have no symptoms of having the flu, blow off 600% more flu viral particles than people that don't get a vaccine. So in other words, they've kind of got, their body is producing this stuff 600 times more than someone else.
Right.
I know. So it gets crazy. Okay, so here we go. I think this is the last thing I'm going to talk about. I just saw this, and it's going to affect all of us, including those of us in healthcare. And it says the rise of robots. 8 professions that will be taken over by AI technology in the very near future. So here they are. Number 1, chefs. Okay, and I bring this up, and they brought it up because I just saw something. They remodeled the McDonald's in our small town of Reedsport, right, which is 4,000 people. They remodeled it. You have a big old kiosk you can now walk up to and punch your order in and pay for it right there, and then you just walk into the counter and get your order. So robots are beginning to replace people in there already, and we already know that we've seen stories of robots that actually can flip burgers over. And so, and then my son, we were talking about that this weekend, about what's happening in food technology and food science, is a huge demand for meal kits. So robots could put together these meal kits. You don't really need anybody to cook much. You know, they can take care of these things real simple.
Uh-huh.
And the next thing on the list is called customer service agents. So answering machines. We've already seen it. How many times are we getting something else to help you instead of a person?
Right.
And
yeah,
I get from Charter Cable when I have problems with my internet. I call the number, and it's pretty nice. There's an automatic machine that will tell you if their power's out in the area and call back later.
Yep.
Or there's a thing that says that directs you to go through a self-help thing, And it'll, you know, 9 times out of 10, it fixes it for me. I don't have to get customer service.
Right.
Okay, another thing on the list are drivers, because we're seeing more self-driving cars, right?
Right.
So, you know, financial analysts. They're more suited to artificial intelligence. Yeah, you know, when you look at some of the studies on these people that predict the stock market, they find that they have their efficacy rate is about 50-50. So you can literally guess and be better than what they do. Journalists, I mean, I guess artificial intelligence can create fake news just as easy as journalists can. So,
right.
Lawyers. And then guess what the last one, there are two more on the list. Manual laborers.
Okay.
And then medics, they said on the list.
Medics.
So here's what they say according to this. It says, as skillful as they are, doctors are simply no match to machines when it comes to accuracy, precision, and the ability to hold raw information. The medical field could be hit hard by automation in the next decade, and future hospital visits may be with robot doctor appointments. Well, I do know that technology and the healthcare industry is rapidly changing, right? As I remember last October, looking at an EKG machine that you can strap around your chest that was small, more accurate than those ones that you rent from the hospital for $1,500 for 4 days. And then and you can wear it 24/7. And the sheer amount of data that it's able to gather is far more than the hospital-based machines. And it only costs you $400, by the way. And that was the first company to come out with these. Over time, they're going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And it just gives a much, much more accurate picture. And they're more comfortable to wear when you're sleeping and everything. It just hooks up to your cell phone, and your cell phone transmits the data to probably a centralized location or database. So I've been seeing more and more of those things. And look, we're seeing more home kits. I mean, literally, if you want to do your fish oil test, which we do in our office, we poke people's fingers. We can give it to you, and you can take it home and poke your own finger and read the results of the reports that come out. You don't necessarily need us. Other than right now, people don't understand the importance of it, right? They don't understand the importance of the omega-3 index. So it takes people like us to educate them with what it is. But they don't need doctors as much as we used to.
Right.
Plus, look how much data you can get online, right? You remember in college, Dr. G, going to looking at the dermatology text and gagging at all these skin conditions that were just gross looking, and you've never seen them before because they're only in medical textbooks. Now you can go online and you can see even worse than we ever saw.
Right.
You can watch procedures for lancing sebaceous cysts on people's backs and cleaning it out. And I'm not suggesting that people go watch it and learn how to do it for themselves, but literally, you almost can.
Yep, you almost can.
You almost can learn how to do it all on your own anymore, and don't necessarily need a doctor who's overly priced these days to do the same things.
Right.
Anyway. I guess that's it. That was my last study I have.
All right. Well, it's about that time anyway.
Yeah, it feels like about that time, doesn't it? Anyway, so that concludes today's show. So until next time, here's to your health.
Here's to your health.